Good afternoon. Why don't we get started with our meeting? Apologize for our late start today. I'd like to call to order the meeting of the Policy, Program Development, and Intergovernmental Relations Committee. Before you are the agenda and the minutes of the October 14th meeting. I would like to entertain a motion for approval. Second. We have a second. Any questions or comments about the agenda or the minutes today? Okay. All in favor? Got one. Okay. Opposed? Okay. It passes without objection. We have two action items today. The first one is the Bicycle and Pedestrian Access Improvement Study and Goals. And we have a presentation by Mr. Bodenheimer.
Okay, thank you all very much. Thank you, Chairman Acosta. Actually, Kristen Haldeman is going to give the presentation, but I just wanted to say a word just at the outset about the presentation and I think the importance of adopting a plan. Obviously, it's important for the board to express its views about how we conduct business here and about what kinds of access improvements we prioritize internally as far as getting people to our stations. But with bike access in particular, it's not just what facilities we put on our property, but also what kinds of trails and paths connect to our property. And for us to be effective at achieving the goals that we may have for promoting cost-effective ways to get to our stations and sustainable ways to get to our stations, we need to not only have policies about how we do business, but grounds for advocating to the jurisdictions that that host us on what things they need to do in order to help us meet these goals. And a board-adopted goal will give us the ability to comment officially on planning and policy actions that local jurisdictions are contemplating. And so we'd look for the formality of a board action. Specifically, we're asking for an endorsement of the bike plan today and a specific goal for bike access to our metro stations of a tripling of the bike access mode share in the PM peak to 2.1% by 2020 and a tripling of that mode of access by 2030. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Ms. Haldeman.
Thank you. I'm Kristen Haldeman, and I'm in the Office of Long Range Planning. I'm a planner. And for a while, I've served as, I think, Metro's point of contact for bike planning matters. So the next slide, which kind of gives us the background for why we conducted this study, is, you know, based on a lot of things that I have heard over the few years that I've served in this capacity. This is, I think, the first time we've kind of taken a look at non-motorized access sort of system-wide to the stations, bicycle and pedestrian access in particular. These are a number of the reasons why we undertook this study, not the least of which were the aging condition of our bike facilities, stakeholders looking to us to provide an increased focus on bicycle matters, and, you know, a need for long-term station access strategies as we go forward. This is a snapshot of how our system facilities are on the bike side. For rail, we have bicycle parking at stations. We have lockers, which are for an annual rental fee, and free racks, about 1,700. Most of them can park about two bikes each. And all of our buses are equipped with racks to hold two bicycles each. Next slide, please. The next slide is kind of a breakdown based on our 2007 Metro Rail passenger survey of how our riders access our system. This is for the AM peak, and you'll notice we do pretty well on the walk side, but on the bicycle side, we're less than 1%. And while, if you note at the bottom, we have grown in the absolute numbers of riders accessing our system by bike, from 2002 to 2007, our mode share is still pretty low. So I see that, and, you know, in the planning office, we see that as a great opportunity and room for growth. So our study process, as we got underway, sort of followed the typical study process, you know, reviewing our policies and plans, looking at data, and then engaging our stakeholders, both on the public side, internally to Metro, and our jurisdictional partners. I think the things that probably struck me the most during the process were internally, there are anywhere from 12 to 15 different offices at Metro that touch in some way on bicycle and pedestrian access. So there really is a need for kind of a coordinated approach to these non-motorized access planning activities. And then on the public side, we held a public meeting that was very well attended. It was a workshop. We asked people to come and talk to us about bicycle and pedestrian access to stations, what their concerns were, what they'd like to see. And we also had an online survey. We had over 1,000 people who filled out the survey. And the thing that struck me the most was people's concerns on the bike side about safety and security of their bicycles in particular. So we kind of use that sort of to frame our process going forward, and a number of the recommendations kind of focus on safe, secure bicycle parking in particular. Next slide, please. Getting right to the meat of it, our study recommendations were really broken out into two categories. Those areas that Metro can lead on its own sort of unilaterally. And these are some of the highlights, one of which is something we were talking about today, which is adopting this bicycle mode share goal. Improving our website, which we've already done, kind of the low-hanging fruit. We've already gone out and made our website a little more user-friendly with the meat of the information on bicycle access really, you know, right on the front of the website. And it had been kind of tucked away, so it's now much easier to find what you need to know. Providing covered, secure bicycle parking facilities. Again, I think an important component to how we improve bicycle access to the system. And then we got into some sort of analytical tools and joint development design issues that we want to ensure going forward that we provide safe and convenient access for bikes and pedestrians through these processes. Next slide, please. The second category of recommendations were really recommendations that focus on Metro and our partners and how we work together to ensure access to the system. And this is really about coordination. It's about, you know, paths of travel to the stations. It's about signage and wayfinding. It's ensuring that as stations are developed that we're not cutting off critical paths or making more circuitous paths, but really trying to make sure that non-motorized access is a top priority for our stations. Next slide, please. So on the policy side, and one of, again, one of our action items today is to ask you to adopt this bicycle mode share goal. And as Nat mentioned in the beginning, we're talking about tripling it by 2020 and quintupling it by 2030. And we would use these goals as a basis for planning our bicycle parking at stations and also sort of as a guidance for, you know, how we go forward in making our facility improvements.
Just one comment about the numbers. Of course, the reason that 12,000 is more than five times 1,600 is that there's passenger growth over the time period as well. So it's just want to explain that math.
Right, so this is, you know, as we're expecting growth to, say, 1 million or so riders about this time, you know, about 12,000 riders on bike is kind of what we're trying to get at in the AM peak. So, thank you. Next slide, please. Is this feasible? Is it plausible?
Oh. With respect to the goals, can you provide any benchmarking as to what other systems are achieving or aspiring to?
At this point, when we put out a feeler for, you know, what goals, or rather what access shares other systems were seeing, I think Portland was probably the only one that we could, you know, get some good information from. And I want to say that they were probably around 4%. So they're, you know, doing pretty well. And for our own stations, our mode share actually varies, you know, on a station-by-station basis. We have some stations that are higher than our stated goal already, and we have some that are well on their way to meeting that goal. And in many cases, you know, it's really about the availability of access to the station. So, and the type of environment that our state in which our stations sit in terms of, you know, the station context, the design, and the type of uses that surround our stations.
I did have a follow-up question. I mean, the goals are aggressive in terms of the percentage increase, but they're fairly modest, I guess, in terms of the real numbers. So assuming that all these kind of area-wide improvements are made, is there kind of a more aggressive goal or what in terms of a percentage increase, say by 2030, 2040, that we could see if we did everything possible and tried to encourage more bicycle ridership to our station, what is possible realistically?
I guess what we'd love to do is hit the goal early, and you know, or if we're on track to hitting it much faster than the policy establishes, then come back and revisit the goal. At the moment we haven't contemplated a more aggressive staging of the policy. But one thing I just did want to let you know about, we can talk about it later, related to goal feasibility, is in the appendix on page 24 of the overall presentation is a listing of, for the stations that already have high bike access, the origins of the people who are actually auto parking at those stations. And we divided it into people who are coming from less than 1 mile away and people who are coming from less than 3 miles away. And basically anyone who's driving to park and is closer than 1 mile from the station should be a candidate for someone we would prioritize for biking. And you know, for 3 miles away or less, you know, there are maybe not all of them, but some of them should be able to be candidates. So I mean, I think this establishes a pretty large market of people who are candidates for this kind of access.
I believe Mr. Downs had a question. I'm going to Ms. Hines.
So that the latent demand is probably higher. Is there a plan to address the facilities where they're already full?
Yes. We have, in the CIP, there is funding for bicycle pedestrian improvements, both state of good repair and capacity improvements. So we're beginning the planning process to go out and visit all 86 of our stations and identify these needs and essentially come up with the needs list and then start whittling away at that list. We do know we'll prioritize that list and, you know, based on safety and security, latent demand, existing demand, future demand, you know, that's how we hope to, you know, address these types of concerns. Like Onise Falls Church, for example, lots of bike access and full facilities, high on the list.
And the other thing that we can do, obviously it doesn't take planning and move forward on very quickly, is just install more bike racks with the capital funds we have.
We have a question from Ms. Hines.
Going back to the question you asked, Mr. Costa, about a stretch goal, if you will, did you all look at the Region Forward plan that COG did and whether or not bicycling plays a role? They're getting ready to redefine activity centers, and it seems to me this might be fit right in there, and maybe there's a stretch goal there out of that work that we could use.
Okay.
Ms. Hutchins?
I guess I'm so familiar with those places that have the access as well as the participation, and I look at some of our stations, and you had on the map, I look at Vienna, and on slide 14 you talk about the partnership role, And I just like to make sure that we're thinking about how to develop those partnerships for access, because the station's there. We probably have racks, and we probably have all sorts of things there at the station. But getting to the station is the challenge. And when we keep looking at those types of things, we really need to develop those real strong jurisdictional partnerships to ensure that we can meet a goal that is more than, I think, attainable. It's just that there sits a barrier there all the time, and it's a hard one for us.
And we coordinate with our local planners, certainly at the TPB level, and jurisdictional coordinators were instrumental, really, in the development of our plan. And I see them also in the next, our next step with the CIP, having an instrumental role there and helping us to really kind of organize all the potential projects, you know, that would fit into this needs list.
Mr. Benjamin? I looked at this whole study and I read the thicker report, and it seems to have turned into, instead of a pedestrian and bicycle access study, a bicycle access study, with a few odd assorted comments about we'll work with the jurisdictions about finding ways for pedestrian access. I'm struck with the fact that there are no pedestrian goals in this. I'm struck with the fact that there are no actions that Metro would take to increase pedestrian access. And I will tell you a short story about my own experience with that. Several years ago, when I was actually working here, and I was the mayor of a small town within walking distance of a Metro station, I put an enormous amount of effort into asking Metro at the Grosvenor station to put a set of stairs at the back of the parking lot. The reason being that everybody who walked from our town and all the in-between places would be, as they approached our station, faced with a large fence, enormous hill, and a hill completely covered with brush and trees. And so I said, if you can just, right where everybody walks over, put in a set of stairs, everybody will go up those stairs, make it much easier, not have to go all the way around to the other side of the station, all the way around the parking lots and the parking garages, which adds about another quarter mile to their walk. And it took 5 years to get that set of stairs put in. I'd like to see a little bit more here about pedestrian access and some goals for pedestrian access. And I guess my second comment is that upper picture that you have there of the unstaffed bike station. And familiarity I have both with part of what went into the design of our Metro system originally and the design of a soup kitchen that I happen to work at and what went on there. When you have unstaffed facilities of that sort, they become attractive as bathrooms, even though you may have only limited access, and they also become potential places for crimes. So I personally would be a little bit concerned about us approving something that has that picture and that concept in it, as opposed to the ones on the lower level, covered racks and bicycle storage and garages. And I'd hate to have this come back to us afterwards, because the approval you're asking us to give is exceptionally broad, and included in all of this is that it will guide the choice of priorities for the capital program. So as much as I very, very much support all of these goals, I'd like to see it broader, in at least in terms of pedestrian access, and noting the fact that we don't want to be building paths to Metro, but we do on our own property want to do things to improve pedestrian access, and perhaps a little bit more constrained in the area of what we might build in order to store bicycles. Secure, yes. Buildings, I get really, really nervous about, and I have this uncomfortable feeling you'll be coming back to us in 2 years with, you know, a plan for 30 buildings and say, but you already approved it.
The one observation, I think it makes sense to think about how to strengthen the pedestrian access. I think probably the assumption that we had for a lot of these was that a lot of the trail connections that would be beneficial to bikes would also be beneficial to pedestrians, and they weren't called out as pedestrian benefits as such. But I can understand. I can understand. Goals. But
we don't have those.
Right.
No, we have recommendations to improve pedestrian connections. And in fact, in this next planning phase for the CIP priority list, pedestrian connections are included in that, along with lighting possibilities, wayfinding, signage. So there is a pedestrian component to it. But yes, it has been crawling out on the bike side. I think it's that less than 1% that kind of sort of pushed it in that direction.
And a good bike lobby. If you could do something to actually put in some pedestrian goals, I would like to see that before it gets to the board. And I'd like to get a clarification as to whether your set of priorities would include building actual structures. I have no problem with covers, but, you know, putting up buildings that eventually will end up either not getting used or staffed, end up being staffed, both of which seem to be included in this proposal.
I will say this: these are illustrative, and that we would want to come back to you for piloting anything before we even do anything on a larger scale.
Okay, we'll revisit the possibilities after the conclusion of the committee meeting and see what we can do.
Thank you,
Mr. Downs.
First, I want to thank you for pushing forward with the development of a bike and pedestrian access plan. My experience over three decades here was that was never a legitimate topic of discussion, and I appreciate the efforts to make this a legitimate part of the overall planning for access here. I noticed, though, in the capital report outlay section, the lowest expend rate project, there are two of them, both at 1.4%. One is bicycle and pedestrian facilities capacity improvements, and the other is replacement of bicycle racks and lockers, 1.4%. I know that you have to deal with engineering and contracts, et cetera, but if it's truly going to be something that's important, it's important enough to get the money out that's already allocated to this set of objectives. So some degree of accountability for seeing improvements that you're envisioning. The other is a question. I'm curious, what happened to bike and pedestrian access issues at the Sarbanes Center?
So the answer to the first question is that's an embarrassing but appropriate question, and one of the things that we're trying to do right now is one of our recent blog posts was to get input from the public about how we actually design a bike room at the College Park Station, which was like the major focus of our efforts, and would have consumed what percent of the capital?
At least $250.
All right.
For planning.
I'm sorry, what percent of the capital for the bike room?
For the year, $4 million, it's probably, it's still a fairly low percentage.
Okay.
But it's, we're in the planning stages, and that's part of the issue with the CIP, is getting our heads around, you know, what are our projects and what are the priority projects, and kind of how we come up with a list that meets jurisdictional, you know, equity sort of needs, gets at, you know, safety and security issues, which are ones that we can do, I think, fairly quickly. And so I think once we get past the planning phase, we are going to have a list, and at that point we should really be able to start moving or cooking with gas, as they say, you know, to really have these projects going. But you're right, they do, and some of them will require engineering and other construction assistance, design, that kind of thing.
And to the Silver Spring Transit Center, we'll need to get back to you about what the details are for that, and we'll have to talk to the project manager.
I mean,
it is the most visible, comprehensive transit center that we're partners with. And my theory is these issues tend to get
value engineered.
Yeah. Oh, my God, we forgot to put that in the final design.
Any other questions? I believe you have a few more slides that you on your presentation, so perhaps you'd like to finish.
Do you want to? We'll talk about the cost and benefits. As we saw them coming out of the study, really was that, you know, in improving our non-motorized access to stations, we are going to help Metro accommodate our projected ridership growth. You know, again, if we look at our growth trajectory, up to 1 million riders, if you look at current mode share, you know, we've got a very high park and ride mode share at 29 or so percent of 1 million riders leaves us with an unmet parking demand. So is, you know, working on non-motorized access issues is a way for us to help meet that demand. We can reduce VMT, vehicle miles traveled, and congestion. We're promoting healthy communities. When we look at the costs, low compared to other modes, and these are some average costs. A secure bike facility, an average cost of $1,000 per space to construct, versus a, you know, parking garage where it might cost us $25,000 or potentially more to construct. Now, that said, you can get very involved with a bike facility. For example, the Union Station facility is probably a premier example of bike parking, which definitely costs more than $1,000 a space to construct. But nonetheless, I think something modest like the photo that we showed of the what we would call a bike garage, something that fits within an existing footprint of a garage, one of our parking garages, I think in that we have some of the construction already taken care of in that it's will be designed in a facility that already has its walls, that it does it doesn't have the same, you know, cost that you'd see at a Union Station type bike station. And then lastly, you know, we have funding included in the CIP that we've already discussed. Lastly, our recommendation that this plan be endorsed as sort of a framing and guiding document for how we proceed with our capital planning, our programming on the bicycle and pedestrian and just sort of generally non-motorized access to the stations, and then to adopt the bicycle mode of access share goals for 2020 and 2030.
Thank you. We have before us a resolution to endorse a bicycle and pedestrian study and to adopt the bicycle mode share goal. Before we take an entertaining motion, I believe Mr. Wells might have a question.
Well, it's partially, I do have a question, but of course, partially to support this as well. But I do believe that there is demand that can be created through what bicyclists have to have is a safe and secure place in both ends of their commute. And certainly what we've seen in D.C. is that we've had a substantial increase of residents and a decrease of car ownership. And what we've seen in even in the building that I work in, when we put more bike racks in, they filled up right away. And I saw that with Eastern Market Metro Stop, that we put bike racks there, they filled up, and certainly other areas. And so as we're building new apartment buildings and condo buildings, and the same as our, you know, regional partners, is that we're putting more first floor capacity in for bikes, so you don't have to bring it up to your you know, apartments or condo. And so Metro is very much has to be a part of this. And I do think that the goals could easily be exceeded if we can match demand with really it's building the infrastructure seems to fill up as quickly once we build the infrastructure. And so the demand is there once we assure someone that they have a safe, secure place at the end of the commute. So I really do support doing this at an aggressive rate and to whatever degree we can accelerate it, because again, these are the lifestyle choices that people are making. They're moving into our region from across America. And I, again, that's not just D.C. I know that's for our region. One of the things that I wondered about this report, though, I was just in Charlotte, North Carolina, and, you know, now that I'm on the board here, I ride light rail just for the, almost like a hobbyist, but they have on their cars, they have a little rack that's for your front wheel of your bicycle that you can get it up out of the way from being out in the common area, and it's in, you know, by a seat. And they have that on each car on both ends by the doors. And I know that we're looking at input at purchasing new cars. Why is that not part of your recommendation? Did you consider it and rule it out?
I'm familiar with those bike racks. We use the same thing in the South Jersey Light Rail. And I don't know if we have it in the new car design. I don't think so, but I'll definitely look at it.
Okay. Well, that is something that I would strongly support that we look at again, and it's just safer for the other folks getting on to have the bike up out of the way. But it also tells people that, you know, during the times we allow it, bring your bike. And so that's good as well. So, yeah, I agree with increasing and being more aggressive about our goals with this. Thank you.
Any further questions or comments? Mr. Bodenheimer, you had mentioned that you would be working on incorporating some pedestrian goals in the resolution prior to the time it goes to the full board.
That's correct.
Okay. So I would entertain a motion to adopt this resolution.
I so move. I do have a question about the concern I raised about facilities, building facilities. That isn't in this motion, and I don't know how this motion is being interpreted or written. I can see some really severe problems that we're headed towards if we go there. And did I understand from something you were saying that we're already in the process of building or designing at least one or not?
We've asked for public comment on how we would, how customers should access a secure bike room at the College Park garage.
Okay,
and so this is something that, you know, has a number of layers of security that we've built into it, including card access and locks internal to it. It would be transparent so that you could see into it. I think it would address some of the questions that you have. One of the things that we'll be coming back to the board with on that particular project is approval of a pricing regime for it, because it will constitute a new pricing, a new part of the tariff. And I think at that point, there will be an action on that I think intimately relates both the design of the facility and the pricing that's developed for it. So I think that provides an opportunity to approve this kind of thing. I think the assumption at this point, and it's not established by policy, is that if it's a rack, it would continue to be unpriced. If it was something that was enclosed, it would probably be priced, and it would therefore be part of a tariff. I'm maybe a little ahead of myself, but
where I'm not at all concerned about the picture, for instance, you had of what it's like in a parking garage, where you have essentially a cage and it's open. I'm much more concerned when there is a closed building, either inside or outside of another building.
Might I suggest, whether the board wants to get into design standards or not is one question, but what I would suggest, understand the concern, is that we come back to you and brief you on the designs mm-hmm. as we go forward before we actually order some.
That's fine. I've had experience with these motions and people coming back and saying, but you already approved it. It was even a picture there. It was there. You saw it.
Would it be helpful to suggest that part of the design of any facility includes an internal review from MTPD or something?
I would suggest, let's just do what I said. We'll come back okay. with some designs and, you know, for comment and that sort of thing and input. Rather than getting into maybe the board getting into the very
specific. I don't want the board to
I know you don't. And that's why I thought, I understand the concern, and I appreciate it. We should come back and just brief the board on the designs we're going forward with. Okay?
I think Mr. Downey had a question, then we'll move to Ms. Hudgens. Okay, Ms. Hudgens?
I would just like to make sure I'm understanding what your concern is, because I'm seeing this as a secure facility. Is it keyed or a pass or something, or is it an open facility? Because Mr. Benjamin spoke to, you referenced your homeless shelter as if someone would use it. I'm more familiar with seeing similar type structures that are keyed and
I think
rented.
All we were trying to convey with that slide was that these are examples of things that have been pursued in other parts of the country, and that we are not restricting ourselves to anything particular, and this is just illustrations of the kinds of things that, that could be implemented. But
so we can address that concern.
I think the general manager's security recommendation would address that.
That kind of thing.
Mr. Benjamin, are you satisfied with the response from the staff? Okay, so I believe you made a motion to approve. Do I have a second? Okay, any other discussion, comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? This motion passes. Thank you. Next on the agenda is the exemption from privacy policy for OIG investigative and hotline records. We have a presentation from Ms. Liu.
Mr. Costa?
Yes, sir.
I'm prepared to move this item. I don't know that we need a presentation, sort of straightforward.
All right. Can we hear a second?
Okay.
Any discussion?
Okay. Mr. Costa, I'm sorry. I just have one question.
Certainly.
Which is, we put this policy in place. Is there a monitoring way that we know how many times the policy is used?
I'll have to, Ms. Luke could address the question.
Sorry. All requests to the public access to records policy goes through council.
Okay, so annually do you report to us on how many were shielded, Ms. O'Keefe?
We actually do a quarterly report on responses to the requests for documents under the public access to records policy. If what you're asking is to have another category, what is it that you're looking at? We could do, and we'd be happy to do. I'm just trying to get a sense of what it is you're looking for. Because
one of the things with these requests, and because we're not sort of governed by the rules, we have our own policy,
correct,
right?
Yes.
So the only concern I would have as a board member is that the policy, that we don't have a whole bunch of things we're saying we're shielding. That's all. You know, out of proportion to the number of requests that we're getting. That's, I guess, what I would want to know is if we're shielding really a lot, then I'd want to understand why that is as a board member.
We're not actually shielding in the sense that that you're envisioning.
Okay.
I think this comes up when there's a request, and there has been one recently, a request for an IG report. Mm-hmm. And the nature of the report is would trigger a privacy issue. We have two policies, our public access to record and our privacy policy. And under the privacy policy, somebody who is the subject of a report has the opportunity to request an amendment to that report if he or she believes that there's a factual error. And so that process is preserved. It's still in place under the amendment. On the other hand, there are other aspects of the privacy policy, not the public access to record policy, that are being that are being addressed in this amendment. So, if, for example, under the privacy policy, people, if there's a system of records and you happen to have a record in that system of records that relates to you, you can request a number of things about that. And the exemptions that we're addressing are specifically for IG reports. Person still has the ability, somebody outside asks for a copy of that report to take a look at it, say whether he or she agrees, disagrees. That whole, if you will, due process is still preserved. So, but certain of the investigations of the IG are treated in a manner similar to police investigations if the circumstances dictate that. So many of the protections that apply to a police investigation are being applied to the IG, but there are still some, if you will, due process rights preserved if a report that may implicate some privacy issues has been requested by a member of the public or the press or so forth. So it's really trying to balance the two policies and preserve certain rights of a subject of an IG report or investigation, but at the same time preserve the investigative integrity of the IG's office.
Thank you. That's helpful. I'm comfortable.
Thank you. Before us is an amendment of the privacy policy. It has been moved and seconded. Any other questions or comments? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? The motion passes. Finally, we have an information item, LRT and streetcar interoperability study, and we have Mr. Bodenheimer.
Again, Robin McElhaney-Smith will give this presentation, but just by way of background, I think as you all know, there are a number of surface transit projects being planned around the region, and we've been asked to play various technical support roles in all of them, from doing station access planning related to the Purple Line to leading the EPA and PE for Columbia Pike, and developing the alternatives analysis for the DC streetcar program. But so along the way, we've noticed that there are different concepts for each of these surface transit projects around the region, and I guess just sort of as the largest transit provider in the region and seeing all of these things, we kind of got the impression that each jurisdiction really was focused on its own project very appropriately, but didn't necessarily know what was going on a regional basis. And we saw that there was an opportunity to provide a coordination role there, really from a technical perspective and a facilitating perspective, more than anything else. I mean, maybe exercising a little bit the regional planning authority that we have in the compact. And so we consulted with the jurisdictional coordinating committee and proposed something to be part of our project development program to help provide some value added by looking at what are the degrees of collaboration and consistency that we could bring to all of these projects to develop specs that could be part of the eventual programming of solicitations and things like that. But fundamentally, what we're concerned with is making sure that in the end, the customer around the region is perceiving a regional transit network rather than a sort of a hodgepodge of different projects. We want them to be as coordinated as possible from a fare systems point of view, from a passenger information point of view, and also from a technical point of view, we want them to be as cost effective as possible and to take advantage of whatever efficiencies there might be in terms of coordinating storage and inspection facilities and other kinds of facilities. So that's what this is. It's a technical effort and to bring some coordination to them, and I'd like Robin to go through the projects and the dimensions, the many dimensions of interoperability that there are. So
thank you. Thank you, Nat. Good afternoon, everyone. When we talk about interoperability, we talk about the degree to which these systems are going to be compatible. In this presentation, we may say integration, interface, interoperability. We're all talking about this. That's what we're talking about. And if you can move to the two slides. When we looked at this map shows all the different projects that are being advanced in the region. Some of them are in just the study phase. Some of them are in the PE and design phase and environmental phases. So they're all at different levels of development. But it really does speak to the need for a coordinated approach. And just so that we don't get 10, 15, 20 years down the road and people say, what were they thinking? You know, as the rider, you want to get from point A to point B, and you don't want to have a lot of transfers, and you don't care about them being different systems. So here, the district has a very broad planning for their streetcar network, but two corridors are being advanced right now, kind of as starter lines. One is the H Street Benning Road, and one is the Anacostia line. And then up in Maryland, as we're all very familiar with, is the light rail called, you know, the Purple Line, connecting New Carrollton to Bethesda. Maryland is also advancing the Quarter Cities Transitway from Shady Grove to Clarksburg. That has not been determined what mode it's going to be. It may be a bus rapid transit. It may be a light rail. And Northern Virginia is studying very extensive, you know, future network. And the corridor that's kind of farthest along is the Columbia Pike Streetcar connecting Pentagon City to the skyline area of Fairfax County. It is being advanced by both Arlington and Fairfax County in partnership with one another. There's also the Crystal City Potomac Yard that there's a segment in Arlington County, and there's also a segment in the city of Alexandria. And there's other corridors here that are in some initial planning stages. So this is why we're doing it, and we have had a lot of great feedback, a lot of interest from the project sponsors. This coordination is taking the form of quarterly working groups. We had our first one back in October. It was kind of a meet and greet, although we know each other very well from just our current professional lives. The point of that briefing was for everyone to come together to understand the projects, each other's projects and what transportation problems they're trying to solve. Be that more of a line haul system, like with the Purple Line, connecting neighborhoods, economic development, they all have different story to tell. You can go to the next slide. After we had this introduction, we broke out into breakout sessions. We wanted to make it fun. We wanted people to come back. So we had one that was crossing boundaries. We're talking about jurisdictional boundaries. We see this Purple Line here, and we see one of the streetcar lines from the district here. No one's looking at that connection. Everyone says it makes sense, but none of the planning studies or the design work to date is looking at how that connection could be made. Would it be a rail interlining? Would it just be a transfer, a platform? And given that one's light rail, one's streetcar, you're probably talking about just a platform interface. Here, another one that jumps out is crossing the Potomac River for the streetcar systems in Northern Virginia to the district. Again, no one's studying that, but everyone thinks it's a good idea. Another thing that came up is common maintenance locations. You know, that implies a high level of compatibility, probably more so than this group has really grappled with yet. But it might make sense if you know, the ones that are in proximity to each other in Northern Virginia or in the district start looking at some commonality there. Right now, every project's looking at their own maintenance facility and shop. They're looking at the smallest footprint possible to meet their fleet needs because coming up with a suitable land, industrial sites within this urbanized area is getting harder and harder to do. The next group was the Transit Riders of the Future. We put on our, you know, most of us are riders, so I guess we kind of put on our own hat. And it was very important to have a consistent fare payment system. So common fare media, be that, you know, the next generation of smart card, that was incredibly important for just kind of the ease of use of the system. Also, real-time information system. You know, this isn't rocket science. Just kind of how you want to ride ride the system is what makes sense. Here, common web-based routing and scheduling information. You can go one place like we do with the metro system to get all your planning for your trip needs. Then this is a very important one. It's common pedestrian safety measures and signage. We want the rider to experience a common how they access the system consistently. These light rail and streetcar systems have a high degree of pedestrian accessibility. That's what makes them so great. You want people to know what to expect. You know, people are crossing tracks with these types of systems. You know, warnings and signage and appropriate lighting. We all thought that was very important. The next one. Then how will they be operated? That gets into, you know, as you can imagine, a host of issues. We just touched upon a few here, having a central hub that you know where all the cars or vehicles are for if there's a delay, if there's an incident, that they can be properly notified. And then we're talking about, you know, energy storage onboard or wayside, having some type of commonality there, commonality with the operating voltages. And then the shared standards, that's really what we're talking about. To have this compatibility, this flexibility in the future, we've got to now look at where we can standardize on some of the features. We probably can't do it all, but what can we do? Okay, next one.
Ms. Hines?
Can I just ask a question before you leave mm-hmm. that slide?
Okay.
Arlington has been talking streetcar. That's what we can afford, quite honestly. We can't do light rail. And my understanding is there definitely are differences between a light rail system and a streetcar system. And I see in the inner jurisdictions, it's more streetcar that people are talking about and different ways to pay mm-hmm. a streetcar versus light rail and all. I guess I want to put a marker in because we're as far along as we are on Columbia Pike, and we think we're going to be advancing the part through Potomac Yard and into mm-hmm. Alexandria, that streetcar in some way gets some earlier look or more intensive conversation. I think DC may be in that place too, so that as we get ready to really begin to move on this, that is done. Seems like it just would help all of us to focus there.
Well, because there's certainly more of the streetcar systems being talked about and planned now than
right. I mean, we think of ours as funded. I mean, we mm-hmm. have a funding plan that mm-hmm. we think is going to be achievable.
So we're not trying to be technology forcing in any or you know or dictating to anyone what their system is.
Right.
Absolutely not. And you know, we're not. We certainly don't want there to be any question about us trying to slow anyone's project down either. So it's really, given where people are and what they've got going, what are the remaining opportunities to get interoperability? So, I mean, if you've got a project plan but you haven't acquired the vehicles, maybe there's an opportunity to have consistency on vehicles. If you baited, so we're basically going to take as a given the progress that people have made to this
right.
point.
Right, and I'm not questioning that. I'm seeing this as you said, this is a value-added conversation. But if what's moving fastest mm-hmm. is streetcar, then let's look at those value-addeds sooner rather than later, since light rail takes longer and the funding is less sure. Or maybe not. I don't know.
Thank you. As you can imagine, our work is focusing on the technical challenges, and quite frankly, that they're pretty significant. But there's also a lot of policy issues that go along with that, and that's one of the reasons we're here today, to kind of start that conversation perhaps with you all. And one is, like, who leads the project? What's the project governance? Right now, as Nat pointed out, we're at the table. We're doing a lot of technical work. We're advancing, you know, kind of some of the work in Columbia Pike. We're a stakeholder, strong partner with the Purple Line, but we're not running the show, and we're looking for, you know, how we can help facilitate. But when you look at all the number of systems that are being advanced right now at the local level, it does beg to question what is the overall project governance going forward. Also, it's regional funding and affordability. You know, there's obviously a certain capacity for the region to fund and operate these systems, and what are having so many systems advancing really do to that picture with respect to competition for federal funding or financial capacity. Then you have, just the safety and oversight, you know, who's going to be in charge of that and what are those protocols going to be. And then, you know, what are the impact on bus operations? Are these systems going to take over some of the bus service, or so would there be some or just the routing be changed and the scheduling be changed? Those are things that we're going to be definitely focusing on going forward, and fair policy, which we've kind of talked about. So I'm sure.
Yeah, and I guess right. I mean, I think that the question is, at a certain point, you know, we stop having a technical hat and start asking questions about what is the how do the projects that are advancing affect Metro, and I'll just give, you know, one example. If you're building a streetcar that's oriented towards economic development as opposed to mass transit, and the design of that system alters Metro's ability to, for example, provide high-capacity bus system, service on a corridor, that changes what Metro can provide in that corridor. As Metro, we don't have a policy about what it is, what kinds of services that we should be providing, or how we should provide service in those corridors, or even how we should comment back on those facility designs. And really, I think this is an information item, but it's in a way also a request for your guidance to us corporately as to are there policies that we should be developing? It's a plan development program for us that starts to give some definition to what Metro's stance is on each of these projects. So bus operations is just one example. The financial capacity of compact members, that's something that we've done back of the envelope analysis on, but we certainly haven't done comprehensive analysis of, for example, what Metro subsidy requirements would be in 2030 versus the subsidy requirements of these additional systems. But that might be work that you would like us to do and to bring back to you with some policy recommendations about what the board stance should be on these kinds of things. So it's really more of an invitation for a conversation amongst yourselves and an issuance of guidance to us about how we should take it to the next step as far as commenting.
I believe that Mr. Wells had a question or comment.
What, I missed it. What level of interaction communication do you currently have with the other transportation jurisdictions on this issue? Is there any at all where you talk about, whether it be how to use the fare cards or what's planned down the road? I guess that is further down the road, but certainly siting and some of the potential joining of infrastructure. So is there a mechanism that you currently use, and are you currently meeting?
I would say right now the study is the mechanism
the
right now.
The mechanism, and we're having quarterly working group meetings with Maryland, the district, Arlington, and Fairfax County. It's ongoing quarterly working group meetings, and we're having the next one scheduled in March. So we're kind of looking at the different features of the system and seeing how far they are in the design of them.
So all of that's happening. And so what do you need from the board, so I understand again?
I'm sorry, maybe I'm...
And then what would you need from the board if you're already meeting? And what...
A clarity, for example, the issue of the compatibility of streetcars with buses, for example. We have a number of priority corridor bus routes. They are co-located with streetcars. There are different conceptions of transportation on those corridors. I think at this point, don't have an organizational position on the jurisdictionally developed projects would be, how they would be designing the facilities. Or an excellent one would be if they also give priority to buses, could you create a shared running way that would work both for buses and for streetcars?
I think what we owe the board on questions like this.
Right.
Is I'm upstairs to take a phone call. Is recommendations back to you as what we think your policy direction should be to us, supported recommendations, and then you can then decide. I think that would be the way to pursue it, is for us to make recommendations.
I got a phone call. Mr. Downey, you had a question?
Another area I think deserves looking at in the sort of regional context is getting the motorists prepared for the fact that streetcars and light rail will be in the environment. That's been an Achilles heel in lots of places. Drivers will be going all throughout the region, really need to have the same degree of understanding and responsiveness in terms of not making the left turns in front of the light rail vehicles.
Mr. Benjamin?
As you've talked with the various jurisdictions, do you have any sense as to how many of them think that after they get done doing their design and development and construction, they're going to turn to us to operate?
I don't really know. I think we've been – it's up in the air in each one of those. I think that we've been it's come up on an ad hoc basis, and we've basically been saying that we're not planning on operating these.
You're not planning on operating.
This is an issue where, I think we okay, maybe. Excuse me?
Go ahead.
Well, I think that, I think consistent with what the general manager said, the thing that we would do would be to bring back a policy to you that had a staff recommendation about what we think we should be doing to guide us in the future.
I guess the issue that I'm getting towards is I don't know to what degree any of the jurisdictions has made that decision yet, and I'm not sure that once they make the decision that it'll necessarily stick for more than a year or two. And there is at least some potential that somewhere down the line we will end up operating some of these fixed route systems, and probably more than one. When that happens, we then start working ourselves into that escalator discussion we were having earlier today, where we have multiple designs, multiple sets of equipment, multiple sets of spare parts, multiple facilities, and all of the things that are associated with that. So one of the questions becomes, is it of interest to the region to, at this point, look at, and I think that was at least hinted in here, look at standardization, coordination, common parts, common facilities, common approaches to things, so that should we end up in a situation where we have a single operator of all of these, that we don't end up with multiple different technologies and spare parts and facilities where it would be more efficient to have less.
Right. Well, it's a great point. And if we didn't think that there was, you know, a risk of that, I think that's definitely one of the concerns that we would have. I mean, if we didn't think that there was a risk of it, it might not have been as necessary. But it's an important question. But I know one question I have talked about is, we would talk about power systems. I mean, if we were starting to talk as if we were going to be the owner and operator of these systems, we would care quite a bit about, for example, whether you had trolley wire versus catenary. And that might be the kind of thing that a local jurisdiction would have a different view of if it was going to operate it. But if we were going to operate it, we would have a very different view. And I'd defer to Mr. Kubitschek.
Well, before you get into all of that, let me just note, you are being very careful and appropriately so not to step on anybody's toes. And it's very easy to do so. On the other hand, I think it's also important for us as a region to look at these as potentially regional systems, which is what you've been talking about. And maybe we need to be more explicit about saying these are things that need to be explored so that we understand how big a potential problem are we creating. And are there some solutions that can be done without getting in everybody's way and pursuing their own projects? And I say that knowing that Maryland is one of the potential problems.
That's exactly behind a lot of this work, to have that conversation and to standardize to the extent practical or even desirable, if we can get that far, given the individual timeframes for the projects and how they're being advanced now.
Ms. Hutchins?
I just want to caution that I think what I heard and hope I am hearing is that we're really thinking of how to connect ourselves around this region and work efficiently without us taking either other over, but rather, and I think of the PSTOC Center, where the Fairfax Ramada and our transportation folks are sharing, and a lot of work that goes on there to make the efficiency of Metro's buses, our buses, et cetera, to work, but no one. We didn't say that we found a partnership, I guess is what I'm saying. And I think that's what we're hearing, that we have customers that have no boundaries as to their commute, and we have services of varying descriptions. How do we make the customer experience work well, and how do we find value? I think it's really a case of value of what's common and what else. I think everybody has kind of resolved the metro ownership role here.
Ownership as it is the potential for operations and acknowledging that there's a need for Metro to tread lightly.
Well,
we don't want to tell anybody what to do.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think the region needs to acknowledge that there is a potential that over time these will become coordinated systems and maybe operated jointly. And as such, we want to do this early stuff so as to facilitate that.
And that's my piece.
I believe Mr. Kubitschek had a comment.
Just a quick clarifier. At this stage, what we've done from a technical perspective is just, participated as we've been requested to come in and support in various modes. Some of the discussions that are coming out
on our part that Nat and them talked about was, for example, how fast are you really going to operate this system? That was one of the things that we asked Maryland, you know, because they're talking about a light rail vehicle. They're a lot more expensive. But if you're not going to operate those things at a high speed, why do you want to put in all the infrastructure to support that, you know, at this phase? And so it's been kind of a technical question with the district and with Maryland and with Virginia, just to kind of form, you know, some opinions and views and just provide maybe a different insight on what's taking place there. But ultimately, again, treading very lightly on what's taking place. And one of the items that we branched off again was, you know, the electrical use, how they run the rail car or the street cars, and they integrate them into possible stations and everything else. Those are some very, very complex issues that, you know, there's a point in time that we definitely have to be a partner or have something to say because of the integration, you know, as those things pose and security and everything else. So, like I said, it's just very, very high level, and we've provided just like some lessons learned, but really just waiting to understand our role.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments, Mr. Downs?
You ask about, is there a framework that Metro should bring to these discussions? Almost every one of these lines assumes some interface at some point with the rail system. I think the authority has to be explicit in its assumptions about what access at what time so that you can preserve the integrity of the rail system, our largest single public works investment in this region is the rail system. Those stations are the hub. If there are expectations about access to those with a light rail system, you have to represent what the authority's perspective is about the integrity of that access. My assumption is as well that if a light rail corridor overlaps directly a Metro bus line, you have to give back the anticipated impact on that bus line to that region, to that part of the region, and they can make their own decisions about reducing, changing the bus system. But clarity about potential impact on from the bus side is important about having that be part of their decision-making process. You do represent the interest of the region in the existing transit capacities, and if interoperability is not just about the light rail systems themselves, it is the interoperability of the entire mass transit network.
Any other questions or comments? I just had a few comments I'd like to make before we close this part of our discussion. First, I think there was a lot of good discussion about how we coordinate with our regional partners with respect to building expanded transit. And I think that's really the most important thing at the end of the day, which is this is providing more access to public transit for the region. I think there are a couple of issues with respect to questions that Mr. Bottenheimer asked that we might want to be a little more explicit about. I think the issue of how we interface with these systems and how we coordinate their design with our assets, I think, is something we would want them to be fairly aggressive about in terms of a discussion. So they point out the, you know, what will work or what will not work, so they're not spending a lot of money going down a, you know, down a track, which is not going to lead to anything. I think they're going to be efficient on both sides. I think it's important that the staff provide some clear guidance. I also think there are a number of strategic business issues that they're asking us to consider. And I think, for instance, I don't think we want to be aggressive about taking over light rail service, a streetcar service, but there may be, as Mr. Benjamin mentioned, a time where we're being asked to take it over for whatever reason, or there might be even a RFP out on the streets to operate the system. And the question for us is, do we want to compete for that, because it is essentially a new line of business that we would be offering. And the question internally is whether we have the
capacity to do that. And I think that's probably a question that we could probably answer internally, so we know what it will take in order to build that capacity and whether we are in a position to operate the service or what would it take to do that. So I think that's a question that staff may want to provide, you know, some direction to us or give us some advice on when we do encounter these things, because it will be a cost to the agency, and we'll have to, and are we taking away from other things will be another question. Also, I think the issue of protecting the agency's interests with respect to the design of these systems is also an important thing. I think a lot of questions were raised about if you're building a system, a streetcar system, which uses the same right-of-way as our bus service, the question is how should our staff react to that? And I guess the question here is obviously we want them to ensure that we provide the best possible service on our bus network where we can maintain our headways, maintain our average speed, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's another point that they may want to raise as part of a follow-up to this study or as phase two of the study. I think there may be some significant impacts to our service as these things are constructed. I think they could design, work with them to design these things well, but I also think they need to be clear about their, you know, what role they're going to play in this, or else they think a lot of these things may get lost as they design these systems, and then we will not necessarily be able to provide a service that's really worthy of this agency. So, Mr. Sarles, did you have a question or comment? Any other questions or comments regarding this issue? Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Finally, we do have a, I guess there's a subsequent policy agenda, committee agenda. I'd also like to ask the staff, I know this is a fairly new committee, but if there are kind of more long-range policy discussions that this committee should have, it'd be probably worthwhile if you raise that in some fashion, whether you want to put together a white paper for the committee's consideration with respect to questions or partnership opportunities or you know, long-range planning issues that the committee should address. I think it would be worthwhile to consider those at some later date. And then we might be able to determine kind of which projects may be worthwhile or which studies may be worthwhile in terms of pursuing. So with the committee's consent, I'd like to ask the staff to do that. Okay. This meeting is adjourned.